All right, welcome. This briefing is about making conservation more effective, an assessment of the RCPP projects as a roadmap for improving future conservation efforts. On June 24th, the Northeast Midwest Institute released a report that analyzes the implementation of the Regional Conservation Partnership Program in six different watersheds in the Upper Mississippi River Basin. This assessment of the six projects confirms the vital role of federal funding in initiating or strengthening these collaborations across various sectors, from state and local governments to educational institutions, agribusiness, and environmental organizations. This briefing is an opportunity to hear from a panel of wonderful experts on the current challenges facing federal conservation efforts, how to overcome them, what this new study says about ongoing conservation efforts, and what a more effective conservation regime could look like in the U.S. through the lens of the RCPP. Our speakers today are from all over industry. Dr. Sri Vidashalam is the Director of Water at the Environmental Policy Innovation Center. His work has addressed national water issues such as affordability, aging infrastructure, extreme weather impacts, financing, and non-point source pollution. Dr. Vidashalam was formerly of the Northeast Midwest Institute, where he was the primary architect and author of this study. Adam Tarr is a senior professional staff of the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry on the minority staff. He joined the committee last month after handling the agriculture and environment portfolio for Senator Bob Casey. Previously, he worked at USDA in a variety of roles, including serving as a senior advisor to Secretary Vilsack, and he began his career at the office of former Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter and is a graduate of Penn State. Aviva Glazer, on my left, serves as the Director of Agriculture Policy for the National Wildlife Federation, leading the Federation's work on the Farm Bill and on other policy efforts to protect and enhance wildlife habitat on working landscapes and to ensure funding for agriculture conservation programs. Adam Carpenter, far right, is the Manager for Energy and Environmental Policy at the American Water Works Association, where he analyzes a wide range of regulatory and policy issues related to drinking water, with a particular emphasis on source water protection, energy policy, cyanotoxins, climate change, and consumer confidence reports. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Vidashalam, who will give you an overview of the report, and then we will go through our speakers. We'll start on my left and then work to my right. And then Dr. Vidashalam will end with a little bit of a conclusion, and then we'll open up for questions. Thank you all for joining us, and I give it to you, Sri.
Thank you. Do I need to use the mic?
I think
you could. That'll go. Okay, I have a few slides, and if we can get the display to work, we can see the slides. Otherwise, I'll just describe how the pictures look like. So the basic background for this project was this issue of nutrient enrichment in our lakes and rivers across the Midwest, but largely the entire nation. The Mississippi River Basin is the largest watershed in the United States. Agriculture is the dominant profession, so that obviously means that people are using fertilizers and manure, and there's a lot of farming, but also animal feeding operations that go on, and that results in nutrient sort of leaching into the rivers and streams. Harmful effects can be algal blooms, but in general, we have water quality issues across the entire basin. The most prominent examples would be Salem, Oregon, and Toledo, Ohio, that came into the news. But even on a regular basis, we have a big nutrient problem with the Gulf. Do we have any estimate of this year's Gulf? It just keeps growing to become the largest. 2016, then 17, 18, so it becomes the largest every year. I don't know if this year is surpassing the previous years. But in general, that's an issue that is best tackled upstream rather than trying to handle that issue downstream. And in talking about upstream measures, conservation is obviously seen as one of the silver bullets, one of the solutions. Tackling problems upstream is appealing. It just sort of in the nature of solving things, that you solve the problem upstream, things disappear downstream. But we have a lot of sort of unresolved questions just in terms of how conservation works, how effective it is. One is we know a little bit about how individual practices are effective in controlling or reducing the nutrient loss, but we just don't know collectively when they work together how over the entire landscape, how does that work? all of the programs that are currently funded at the federal level, but also funded at the state, local, private foundation, philanthropic levels. They're all typically voluntary programs. So farmers are incentivized to adopt certain measures. They're provided compensation. So again, it's still voluntary. So we don't know how much, what is the participation rate, whether that drops off, people enroll, people get out. So there's the, you know, just the whole dynamics of how this process works over the long term. And we also are sort of going with the idea that moderate compensation to, you know, install these features, these practices can make long-lasting changes. We don't know if that is true. And again, the larger question of scaling up from each individual farm to the entire watershed, how does that look like? And can this be an effective policy by doing a patchwork of, you know, individual farms and, you know, farmers trying to do the right thing? Can that scale up to become a big watershed scale level, you know, program that can be effective? We did not set out to study RCPP. That was not our goal. The idea was simply to understand how conservation works and can we measure that in some clear, reliable way. Is there a way we can assess the effectiveness of conservation programs? Just on the idea of water quality, but also any other resulting economic impact. So that makes the larger case for why we should be spending on water quality. If you can convince the local, you know, county or the city that there are other benefits like improvement in the water supply that goes to the nearest city, improvements in the lake that allows recreation. So there are these ancillary benefits, and that can make the case for you know, enhanced conservation. But the idea of RCPP was appealing to us because it provided a very neat framework for sort of looking at this issue because of the way RCPP is structured. And it is it's structured in a way that brings partners together, so it's a collaborative engagement process where diverse stakeholders come together. There are upstream farmers, other entities, soil and water conservation districts. There are downstream utilities and cities who have a vested interest in improving that water. So there is that natural dynamic that we thought would be leveraged if we look at RCPP. There is an emphasis on water quality monitoring. So because there are downstream entities that are interested in that process, in the outcome, there is a larger incentive to make sure that there are results that are being achieved. So all of the money that is being spent, what are we achieving out of that? So there's some accountability for that. And beyond the length of the five-year RCPP project, we felt like that has the potential to form long-lasting bonds within the community. So individuals or groups who are skeptical of each other, who probably wouldn't have interacted with one another years ago, came together, and would that be a beginning of a relationship that outlasts the 5 years that the federal funding is, you know, sort of accounting for? And do we have something? Maybe. Okay. So we started with. I'll wait for this buzzing noise then. So the map in front of you shows six different locations across the four upper Mississippi states. So our universe for selecting the projects was about 22 RCPP projects that have some component of water quality as part of the project outcome. So that was our sort of universe, and we started looking at, you know, who the entities are. Again, if it involved a utility, a city, we are a water commission, a watershed agency, we felt that that was going to be one of those examples where monitoring was emphasized, there was accountability, rather than just simply saying, okay, here's, you know, it's output-based. We gave money to farmers, they installed, you know, cover crops, or they installed bioreactors, and we left the project there. So we wanted to sort of find examples where there was that, you know, sort of two-way approach. So there is one project each in Minnesota and Iowa, and two in Illinois and Wisconsin. The one in Minnesota is actually, I highlighted a particular point, but it's actually a statewide program. I'll explain a little bit briefly, but it's structured very differently from the other RCPP projects. The way each of the projects, typically each of the projects is structured, is it is conducted in a watershed. It's specific to a watershed, And in that, that watershed could be differently sized. So there are, if you look at the Huck sizes, Huck 12 is the smallest watershed, Huck 10, and then Huck 8. Most of the projects are at the Huck 8, Huck 10 size watershed. Huck 12 is the easiest, sort of smallest place to work in. So a lot of the projects do actual work in the Huck 12, but then they do multiple Huck 12s, or, you know, they are spread across. So sometimes they can be a bigger size watershed. Oftentimes the work is conducted in a much smaller watershed. I've just shown a few attributes of the six projects. I wanted to highlight a few things. One, the first year of funding was 2014-15. Four of our projects were supported in that year, so they've had a few years. They are close to maturity, so it was easier to, you know, make some conclusions, some assessments of those projects. The other ones are fairly new. Otter Lake is the newest. In fact, that project has not taken off. So it's listed. We try to evaluate the project, but there are no actual achievements because they have not gotten the money. It's a source of complaint for the person running the project. The other thing I wanted to highlight is the project leader. And if you see, I just highlighted a few things there. Different things jump out. So there's a county, there's a city, Department of Agriculture. There's a collaboration between a city and a nonprofit. There's a water commission and a trade group. So all sorts of, just these are just project leaders, not including the stakeholders that are actually involved. In many cases, there are universities that are providing sampling support. You know, they do the lab testing. They provide students for, you know, monitoring. And there's a whole range of stakeholders that have come together to do these projects. So that's sort of a highlight right from the beginning, that they are doing something right in terms of reaching out to a variety of stakeholders working together. The way we tried to evaluate the project, we just developed a broad set of criteria. We looked at the project background, what the conditions were in those watersheds, what were the objectives that they set out, you know, and how far they came through to achieving those. What was the monitoring, you know, plan, the sampling protocol, what was the extent of it, what were the observed improvements, if any, and this was the hard part there, trying to disassociate the results that some of them showed from just natural, you know, weather patterns, right? You know, there was flooding in one year, you know, that can change. There was drought followed by flooding, so that has a different impact. That was a challenging point there. We also looked at whether the projects were measuring economic benefits. Were they thinking about it? What was their view on that? And how they were trying to identify revenue stream that would outlast the project itself, this five-year cycle. So were they thinking about project viability in a way that would sustain the project long-term, you know, with local community support, maybe additional sources of funding that are state-based or, you know, private foundations, but not reliant on federal government simply because there is not enough money to, you know, go around. And finally, we used a model called Hawks. It's an EPA software. It's developed as a way to... It's similar to a model called SWOT, which is fairly commonly used in this field, that does a large-scale modeling of watershed and land use. Hawks sort of runs off on SWOT in a much more easier way. And with that, we did historical and projected water quality data. And with each of the projects, one thing we did was we tried to identify a unique element. We know that when somebody's critical, or, you know, trying to look at it from a critical viewpoint, everything can seem like a negative. Oh, they didn't do this. This was not right. But we wanted to force ourselves to pick something that was right, that was a highlight, that was worth sort of pointing out, that, you know, shows potential for success in various spheres, and we try to do that in each project. Just to give you an example, this is the Middle Cedar Watershed in Iowa. The bottom of the watershed is Cedar Rapids. The city of Cedar Rapids relies on the Middle Cedar. The upper watershed is the Upper Cedar, and the lower part is the Middle Cedar. So that's the watershed that we looked at. And if everything is clear to you, I'll just go from left to right. So on the left, do you have a pointer? All right, so on the left, you see historical data in black, and then this is projected future data. This is average yearly flow, that's surface flow. And if you see, there's not much variation across, you know, the many, you know, 50, 60 years that we look into. So I drew a straight line just to give a comparison. So the dots are individual annual readings, and the smooth line is just sort of a running average. So there's some ups and downs, but largely it's uniform. But what we also wanted to look at was it's spread across the seasons, and that's an interesting point that comes across in most of these watershed models. Is if you look at the table below, it shows the first row is annual, so that shows what's the change annually. 3% in the near term, and by near term I use the next 30 years. 2010 to 2040 is the near term. 2040 to 70 is long term. So in the near term, there's only a 3% increase in average water yield. But in the long term, it goes to about 18%. But the big difference is in how it's spread out. In the winter and spring months, you get anywhere from 30 to 40% increase. And that's where you'll start to see the changes. That's where you need to pay attention, is that you have this high increase in spring and winter months, where you have snow, but because it's warm, it melts immediately, so you have spring melt, and that results in something that we saw this spring. We also developed four conservation scenarios, actually three conservation scenarios, one baseline scenario. And the way we model, again, this model looks pretty similar to the previous chart that I showed. There's historical data from 1980 to 2010, and then there is projected future data. And there are four sort of curves, and each one describes a scenario. So in the box below, the control is the most basic one. It simply projects current conditions. It assumes there is no conservation going on. So what happens if there's no activity going on? The next one is called continued. We use data from each of the projects. We ask them how many acres of cover crops were installed, any bioreactors, wetlands, all sorts of things that they could identify. And we said, okay, if we took these activities, and then after 5 years, we assume that everything stopped. They basically lost funding. It's almost as though the department that was doing the work simply disappeared. But the people who are doing those activities continued to do them for some reason. Maybe there was just enough money, or maybe they felt like this was the right thing and they kept doing. So it's sort of a minimal conservation that was going on. The next scenario we said was expanded. We expanded the ongoing activities by about 10 times. So we thought that was a big jump. So can we scale it up in an aggressive way? What does that look like? And then the full implementation is a scenario where BMPs are implemented in all of the farmland across the watershed. And these charts show you average yearly phosphorus load and then nitrogen load. They look roughly similar. They have the same shape roughly. Same pattern. The numbers are different though. And you'll see the difference between the baseline scenario and the continued is pretty small. So basically saying that the ongoing conservation activities don't have much of an impact. They have some impact, but not they're significant, but not that noticeable. You make a big jump when you increase the program by 10 times and then get a much bigger difference when you go to the next full implementation. This is just that same chart zoomed up to show that difference. Again, here the individual readings are the annual readings, and then the smooth line. So there's a lot of variation in each annual reading. And again, when I say annual, it's an annual average, which means the spring values could be much higher compared to end of the summer or winter values. So keep that in mind. We took those charts and then made them into load reduction values. And I'll go through these really quickly. This is just to show, again, in exact percentages what that means. So when you do, when you do the smallest RCPP program, you get anywhere from 6 to 7% reduction in the load. When you scale it up, you get, anywhere around 30%. And then you scale to the highest level, you get about 70% reduction. This is in Middle Cedar. It changes in different places. I want to jump to the conclusions. We'll come back if you have more questions, but I want to point out what did we notice from each of these projects. We found that the role of federal funding was significant. Each of the players identified RCPP funding from the federal government as a key stimulant in initiating the project, expanding the project, bringing more stakeholders, expanding it from a pilot project to a bigger full-scale project. So all sorts of advantages that people pointed out when they said this is what we got from getting the RCPP funding. So that was sort of affirming of the role the federal government plays. There was a diversity of institutions that we noticed in each of those projects, within the project, across projects. And RCB was always in response to a water quality issue. So it was not like people saw the money and say, oh, hey, let's get together and use this money. There was a need. There was an ongoing work that was going on. So this was simply expanding those activities using the funding. Phosphorus was a major concern in three of the projects. Nitrogen was a major concern. The others highlighted both phosphorus and nitrogen, which is, again, pretty technically, but I think that is something that communities are thinking about. There is inconsistent monitoring. Even though there was emphasis on monitoring, there was no particular standard or protocol that was issued. So there was different ways. Some projects excelled in having a pretty cool sampling protocol and monitoring, you know, paradigm. They set out with what they wanted to measure. They used state monitoring data. They employed other resources like state agencies to sample those streams and those watersheds more consistently for the length of the project. Then there were others that used baseline data from the state 2 years ago and decided that they'll sample at the end of the project. So basically 7 years after they started the project, they were going to sample the whole watershed again. So there are, you know, there were a lot of inconsistency in how they did that. Cover crops were a popular conservation practice. They are seen as somebody called it a gateway practice. It was a way to entice, bring farmers who are not thinking about conservation into that, you know, sort of mold of, you know, bringing them into the group. But overall, it is seen as a less efficient practice than some of the other edge of field practices, buffer strips and wetlands and bioreactors, at least for the nitrate removal. But again, cover crops are popular because farmers get incentivized to do that. I mean, there are incentives not only to doing the practice, but it gives them benefit also on the land, whereas edge of field practices don't give you benefit on the land. So that's, you know, that's sort of both sides of cover crops. Most of the, I would say all of the project leaders excelled at outreach and engagement. They had extensive outreach built into their project, and they were reaching out into underserved communities. Some of them targeted beginning farmers, black farmers, women farmers. NOL is non-operating landowners. So these are landowners who own the land but simply don't live there. So they rent it out to people and then they just leave. So those are hard to target because people who are renting cannot make changes. It's like you're renting an apartment and you want to make a wholesale change to your, you know, the whole place. It's just not possible. You need to get the landowner involved. And so that is a big issue with many of these farms. So they were targeting those sort of reclusive farmers. Project viability was not something that was highly thought of in most projects. There were some that identified that, but mostly they didn't really seem to think about what to do beyond the 5 years. So that's one limitation I found. There, as I said, there were unique elements in each of the projects. In most projects, there were computer models that were used to target priority farms, so using technology in agriculture, trying to identify where can you get the most reduction by, you know, sort of pinpointing sources. So where do you start with? Which farms should you target first? There were state programs that complemented the federal conservation support. So one was the Wisconsin in Oconomowoc. They highlighted that particularly, and the state of Minnesota. Wisconsin and Minnesota have state programs that sort of complement the ongoing efforts. Wisconsin gives a credit to utilities if they are able to engage farmers rather than, you know, do treatment at the plant itself. And Minnesota is a whole another ballgame. Their program is highly ambitious. They are basically going farm to farm and saying, we will evaluate each farm and look at all of the practices that can engage or impede water quality, and we'll try to fix them. Now, whether it actually does improve water quality, we're not concerned about that at the moment. Our goal is to make sure everyone can actually feel like they have achieved all of these, you know. They'll go and, it's basically like an inspection. They go and assess the field and say, oh, Pierre, your manure is not, you know, sort of covered. It's you know, on a slopey land, so let's fix the slope. Let's build a shed. You know, all of that. We know it will impact water quality. We don't have to measure it. We know that this will do. So that sort of thing. That's pretty unique, I would say. It's very different. It sets them apart. Also made it really difficult to, you know, assess them in this project, just the way they were structured. And as I said, targeting non-operating landowners, women, through learning circles. So another thing some projects did, especially the one in Upper Macoupin, is most projects, when they do outreach, they do, you know, events like this. Everybody's sitting, you know, you do a farm show, you do a county fair. But they found that, you know, targeting women farmers was much different. You needed to do much, you know, different approaches. So they came up with something called a learning circle, which was much more intimate rather than doing these large-scale county shows and, you know, state fairs and things like that. You know, all projects, typically, we found that they validate the RCPP approach of bringing players together, working with them, providing them seed money, but then letting them design their own projects. Climate change was identified as a major variable by all of the project leaders. They felt like this was something they were thinking about. It's just that they didn't. It was not institutionalized in the way the projects are set up, but they did highlight something that they've been thinking about. Last couple slides. I pointed out that Middle Cedar watershed had the 3%, 18% increase in annual water yield. That was on the low end. Some of the watersheds have 80% increases planned in the future. So this is going to be the big issue in the upper Midwest, is you have huge amounts of rain that's, you know, rain, snow, that's coming in disproportionate amounts and also not spread across the seasons properly. So that's one of the biggest issues. This is the summary of all the results that we found. So the two charts are showing phosphorus and nitrogen reductions, and they're broadly into, again, those three scenarios: continued, expanded, and full implementation. We get anywhere from 3 to 6% reduction in loads, phosphorus, nitrogen. I didn't show sediment here. We also included sediment. If you continue the existing RCPP programs, if you expand it 10 times, you get about 17 to 27% reduction, and a full implementation gives you somewhere around 50 to 55 to 60%. So, you know, there's a lot that would need, the scale of the conservation program would have to be expanded by a lot, that, you know, needs additional funding. But also it could be some creative approaches. So one option we suggest is expanding certain select projects on a 5 to 10x scale and seeing if, you know, we are seeing these kinds of reductions. So is that beneficial in providing, you know, sort of a boost in funding to certain specific projects on a pilot scale to see if, you know, this approach can be helpful in achieving these conservation goals faster. Incorporating climate change projections in all of the models that, you know, the federal government uses, all of the funding that federal government provides, that can be a boost as it, you know, travels, trickles down downstream. State efforts should complement federal support, not inhibit. We found one example where it did in Iowa, but I think overall state government should be aligned in sort of complementing and boosting the existing federal support. Streamlining monitoring standards and providing some sort of targeted funding that is specifically for monitoring, as it's not done right now. Addressing long-term viability. This again is a sort of long-term thinking, but you need to start sort of planning it now because you have limited funding. How are projects going to scale up and are, you know, disassociate themselves from the federal funding after 5 years? And there was one issue with the 2014 Farm Bill that limited the transfer of funds across different pools, which has been, I think, adequately addressed in the new Farm Bill. But the projects that are funded under the old Farm Bill still have parts of money that are sitting unused. So we suggest some way of, you know, transitioning those funds or allowing them to spend those funds. We see a clear role for citizen activism. There are a lot of lawsuits pending in, you know, local municipal courts, county courts, that are challenging this, fighting on behalf of watersheds, or, you know, like Toledo has the personhood for Lake Erie. There are a lot of these suits that are waiting to happen if we don't take action. So please beware. Thank you.
All right, we'll transition over here.
Thank you all for being here. Thank you for the presentation, for the report. I don't have a slide to show, and I will motor through this so that we have enough time for questions and a discussion of the report, because I think it's super interesting. I'm here on behalf of Senator Stabenow's office. For folks who are not aware, Senator Stabenow when she chaired the Agriculture Committee in 2014, sort of championed the creation of this program in that Farm Bill, and she championed and worked closely with a lot of other committee members on significant improvements that were made to the RCPP program in the Farm Bill that Congress passed last year. So she's personally very interested in seeing this program be successful and seeing it deliver conservation, badly needed conservation on the ground. Quickly, since I'm here on behalf of the Agriculture Committee staff, I think I should just say a few things about the Farm Bill that Congress passed last year and that is currently being implemented by USDA, first and foremost. And I realize, given the immense need that is out there on the landscape, this is kind of a sad bragging point, but the fact is that the Farm Bill did not cut conservation spending. We would love to see more conservation spending, but the political reality that we face was sort of not cutting spending out of the conservation title was kind of the best case scenario. Within the conservation title, we did see money get shifted around, and one of the programs that did get a funding increase, a significant funding increase, tripled, is the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. So I think there's a broad coalition on the Hill of both members, but of also outside groups that do want to see the program succeed. A couple of other Farm Bill programs that or Farm Bill changes that I think are worth mentioning is, you know, you see a significant new emphasis on water quality throughout the title of the Farm Bill. So whether that be with an emphasis on source water protection in EQIP, CSP bonus payments for cover crops, or the new initiatives within the CRP program, which is the land retirement program at USDA. Throughout the title, I think Congress made it very clear that we want to see a renewed or a stronger emphasis placed on water quality practices. Not to diminish the wildlife stuff, but Aviva is going to talk to you all about that, and she knows much more about it than I do. It's obviously a valuable part of the bill, and I think there are good things there as well, but I think today we're obviously focused on water quality. With respect to the report itself, I thought the basic descriptions of the projects were in and of themselves valuable, I think, to anyone who cares about the program. But you also managed to sort of hit on and highlight some key issues that folks that work on conservation face every day. Already talked about it. We need more funding if we're going to see conservation succeed, if we're going to achieve these goals that we've set out. That's one of the advantages of the Regional Conservation Partnership Program from our perspective. It leverages federal funding. Partners come to the table. They bring additional resources to the table. The added benefit of that is it broadens the political coalition. You get more folks with skin in the game. When Congress has to decide, are we going to fund this program or are we not, you've got other folks who can come to town and speak to the value of the program. Because you know, if you work in this long enough, you know that farmers are busy planting and harvesting or dealing with floods or trade wars. And so you need all sorts of other folks who can come to the table and speak to the value of these programs. Another element that I think comes up throughout this, and it was something that many of us discussed in the context of the Farm Bill, is we need more data on these programs, and we need to do a better job of measuring their impact. That just sort of tells us how we're doing, but again, it provides sort of political ammunition for folks who want to come and, again, speak to the value of these programs and advocate for their continuation. Another issue that came up, and I think you kind of closed with this, is the sort of question of which practices do we fund? There are some practices that we know are sort of more cost-effective, but the payoff, they're more expensive, the payoff is longer, and so, you know, right now there's a lot of talk, especially in the context of climate, on cover cropping, and that is great. I'm not the guy to not cover cropping, but there are all sorts of other practices that, you know, we need to consider, and those are tough decisions that folks at USDA have to make. And then finally, sort of innovation. You talked about the programs in Minnesota and the regulatory certainty that comes along with that. I came to this job from the Chesapeake Bay watershed. They've been dealing with sort of regulatory and clean water issues for a very long time there. And I think it would be good to see that sort of innovative thinking maybe spread to that watershed as well. The Wisconsin example was interesting. Just really quickly in terms of what's next, Farm Bill's law, and so the big decisions that have to be made are now being made at the Department of Agriculture and up from there. But folks do have an opportunity now to weigh in. So whether you're in sort of a member office that is interested in conservation, or you're with an NGO or you know, a city or municipality, now is the time to sort of thinking about getting in and weighing in with USDA and sort of shaping their decision making. And that's also sort of what we are spending our days doing. Senator Stabenow has weighed in, along with Senator Ernst and a number of other members, on numerous sort of farm bill issues, and we'll continue to do that. And with that, I think we'll just move along. Yeah. Thanks.
Great. Great. All right. So I'm Aviva Glazer from National Wildlife Federation, and I'm going to touch on a lot of the same points that Adam just touched on and that were brought up in the presentation, and kind of give you the environmental NGO perspective on this. For those of you who aren't familiar with National Wildlife Federation, we're one of the oldest and largest conservation organizations with affiliates in almost every state. We work on a wide range of issues, including land, water, wildlife, climate, connecting children to the outdoors. I work on Farm Bill and other private lands issues. So, to start off, I think that just the scale of the problem is worth, taking another second to acknowledge, because we do have a very serious water quality crisis on our hands, as can be seen by harmful algal outbreaks across the country, growing dead zone, unsafe drinking water in cities and rural areas. As was said in the beginning, agricultural non-point source pollution is the leading source of water quality degradation in rivers and streams, second leading source for lakes, and most rivers and streams, or the majority of rivers and streams in this country, do face some sort of water quality pollution issue. These are just a few headlines pulled out just from the last week or two, again, just showing the scale of the problem. Dead zones, every Mississippi beach closed due to toxic algal blooms, nitrates linked to cancer, etc. But there are, I think, reasons to hope and, steps forward that have been taken and are continuing to be taken. There is a growing concern among the public and a growing awareness around this issue. I think that toxic algal blooms, are an easy way for people to understand this issue, because you can actually see it, you're affected by it, and unfortunately, we've seen a lot of those. As was said earlier, states have been stepping up with more actions on this issue. We're seeing nutrient reduction strategies being implemented, state laws and actions like the Wisconsin and Minnesota ones that were mentioned, but there's a lot of other examples as well. And the private sector has been stepping up as well. We're seeing a lot more supply chain initiatives, some of the big food and ag companies driving some of this change and taking on soil health and water quality initiatives. As Adam said, the Farm Bill did have some significant wins for water quality, in addition to wildlife wins, which I won't go into in this briefing, but I'm always happy to talk about. The conservation title, the fact that that wasn't cut is actually a huge victory, especially looking at the previous Farm Bill, which cut billions of dollars from the conservation title, and then appropriation cycles that cut, further hundreds of millions every time. So to have a Farm Bill that maintained the baseline of the conservation title, followed by an appropriations bill, and hopefully continued appropriations bills that don't have any cuts to conservation, that's great. That's huge. The bill also included a lot of new incentives and great provisions for cover crops and other conservation practices. Like Adam said, increased funding and significant tweaks to the Regional Conservation Partnership Program that we think are going to make it a lot easier for farmers to participate and for partners to participate. Increased funding for easements. Again, this long-term conservation is an important part of this, not just short-term, but having long-term viability, and easements are a great tool for that. Source water protection provisions were another important win in the bill, and I think Adam's going to talk more about that in just a minute. And then the new initiative within the Conservation Reserve Program focused on clean lakes, estuaries, and rivers. And that's just a few of the many great things in the bill. However, it's not enough. Even with all those wins, it's not enough. And one thing that the study said, and I have a quote because I thought it was just a good one, is that, you know, the funding allocated for conservation, it's not enough to meet the scale, to meet the severity of the water quality challenge facing the Mississippi River Basin and beyond. Despite the billions of dollars that we've invested in conservation over the last few decades, we're still facing these significant water quality challenges. We still have this crisis in our hands. So we do need to scale up, and we need to drive more conservation, but we also need to be creative in figuring out the solutions, because it's not just going to be one solution. Part of that solution is more funding. You know, in this past Farm Bill, we were fighting to not get cut. You know, as we start to think, it's never too soon to think about the next Farm Bill, and as we start to think about it, you know, I think we need to be thinking about asking for increased funding, because the need is there, the resource needs are there, and the demand is there. The programs, the supply, the demand far outpaces the supply for the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. In some states, only 1 out of every 6 applications are funded. Easement programs, some years only 15% of the easements have been funded. We know that we have willing farmers and ranchers who want to sign up for this. We just don't have the funding for it. And then we also need to use that funding to leverage funding from private sector, from partnerships, and again, that was sort of what Adam was saying with the RCPP program, that is a model for how we can do that, and maybe a model that we can, you know, take and expand and scale up. However, we're never going to have enough funding to pay every farmer for every acre of land to have conservation on them, and that's kind of a reality that we need to be faced with. And so, you know, it is important to make sure that we're targeting conservation funding to get the biggest bang for the buck, to make sure that the funding is going towards the most effective practices, towards practices that have multiple natural resource benefits, so that, you know, there's a lot of practices out there that have benefits for water quality as well as for soil health, as well as for wildlife. So, you know, really targeting those practices. Practices that have high environmental benefits but low return to farmers, like the edge of field practices and buffer strips, wetlands, those are the kinds of things that you can't really expect farmers to adopt on their own without any incentive. So really making sure that we're targeting those kind of practices with funding. And then the other practices like cover crops that do actually have a lot of benefits to farmers, thinking about the transition for those farmers. It is hard for farmers to adopt new practices like cover crops. So, you know, maybe we should be targeting that funding towards the first 3 years or the first 3 to 5 years and figuring out what barriers that are needed to be removed so that more farmers can adopt these practices. And again, focusing on long-term conservation strategies and increasing our technical assistance capacity. We need more boots in the ground. The agency has been understaffed, USDA, and that, you know, it shows, because you really do need to have more folks out there talking to farmers, helping farmers figure out how to be part of these programs and how to adopt more conservation. I think there's also an opportunity with crop insurance to better align crop insurance with conservation, trying to figure out how we can make some tweaks to crop insurance that will encourage practices that are low risk and provide benefits for soil health and water quality. So things like cover crops, which again have benefits to farmers' bottom line, to their yields, it can reduce risk because cover crops help to improve the ability of soil to store water. It allows farmers to better withstand droughts and floods and other kinds of severe events. So those kind of things, you know, we should be making it easier for farmers to adopt those practices. The Farm Bill did take a pretty big step forward by making it easier. It took away some significant barriers that were in there or that were in the crop insurance program. So now it is easier for farmers to adopt cover crops and maintain their crop insurance coverage, which is critical because, you know, farmers need to have that coverage. so, you know, thinking about whether there's other areas where we can be tweaking crop insurance to removing barriers, making it easier for them to adopt those practices, or even, you know, using crop insurance to help pay for some of this good stuff. Iowa started a pilot program with paying farmers $5 an acre through crop insurance premium subsidies for cover crops. You can also be thinking about whether crop insurance can be tweaked to make it easier to take the most unproductive acres out, those areas that are really prone to erosion and have really low yields. Maybe we should be making it easier for farmers to put that into long-term cover. And there's a lot of other ways that we can be thinking about it. There's also, you know, as I think is the main point of this report, the need for improved monitoring and evaluation is very significant. You know, we really do need to make sure that we are doing a better job of assessing where our conservation dollars are going and how effective each practice and each program is. The 2018 Farm Bill did include some provisions related to data collection and monitoring, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. I've included two bills that were introduced last Congress related to that. One is the Ag Data Act by Klobuchar and Thune. And parts of that were included in the Farm Bill, but not the whole bill. And that specifically directs USDA to collect data on individual practices, conservation practices, and how they affect yield and other factors. And then the Healthy Fields and Farms Economies Act, that was not included in the bill, but was a really important marker bill that was put out there related to directing USDA to track the conservation programs, each program, making sure that we're seeing how effective they are, what that money is used for, and then being able to switch the programs up and improve their effectiveness based on that monitoring. So USDA does have the authority to do more monitoring and evaluation of conservation programs. That's something that we are encouraging USDA, since they are able to do it, to do more of. And, you know, again, as we look towards the next Farm Bill, it's something else that, you know, we think we should be talking more about. And then just finally, some concluding thoughts. This is a big crisis, and so we do need big actions. We need to move quickly and boldly to address it. We did just pass a great Farm Bill with fantastic wins for wildlife, but there's still a lot more to be done. And there are, you know, as Adam said, there's a lot of opportunities to influence the implementation of the bill. Voluntary conservation programs are fantastic, and we need more funding for them, but they're not enough. They have to complement things like the Clean Water Act and regulatory structures, as well as the state laws and initiatives that should be complementing, not inhibiting. But it needs to be kind of a patchwork, with the supply chain and private sector also having a role. But to move forward, we need to make sure that all solutions really are all on the table, and we're leveraging partnerships and working together to try and solve this crisis.
Shows up here,
not up there.
There we go. Now, but not here though.
Yeah, I'm not sure what that's about.
I'm happy to just talk.
Well, we might need to do that. Can we? Yeah.
Why don't you just leave that up?
Okay.
Center it so you can just center it, and then we'll just leave that up.
All right.
All right, so with our technical difficulty after technical difficulty, just wanted to introduce myself really quickly. It's okay. I'm Adam Carpenter, and two Adams on one panel, with the American Water Works Association here in Washington, D.C. We're a member association primarily representing drinking water utilities, so these are the folks who make your tap water all over the country. We have 50,000 members. There are 4,200, that includes 4,200 utilities. We also have members who also do wastewater, stormwater, water reuse. Pretty much every product or service that has to do with water, we have members in that category. So we spent a considerable amount of time thinking about. We participated a little bit in previous round discussions in the Farm Bill in previous years, but we realized that there's a real opportunity to build collaborations and to improve relationships between the agricultural community and the water community, and really make a huge difference for drinking water and for water quality through the 2018 Farm Bill. And so we spent a considerable amount of time and effort working with our partners, coming up on the Hill, working with USDA and through NRCS and others to try to figure out how can we make source water protection a key part of conservation programs. Now, the first question, of course, you may be asking yourself is, what is source water protection? Basically, the source water is the water that is eventually used to become drinking water. So whatever river, lake, stream, other source of water, groundwater, sometimes it's water reuse, but usually it's a surface water or groundwater. Wherever the drinking water originally comes from before it goes in the treatment plant, that is considered source water by the sector. And source water protection is the proactive approach of finding ways to reduce risks in the area that provides that water, to reduce inputs of things that are undesirable for water treatment, undesirable to be in the finished water, to help maintain both the quality and quantity of water to assure that we have safe and affordable service. And why source water protection? Oftentimes, when we hear the word water quality, we're talking specifically about the goals of the Clean Water Act, right? So the total maximum daily loads and impaired water bodies. Think of a Venn diagram that I would love to show you if I could get it to work. Imagine two overlapping sets of goals. One is all these goals under the Clean Water Act that are the general ambient, includes some provisions of public health, but it's primarily focused on the environment. And then imagine source water protection as another circle with some overlap that's squarely on protecting public health and protecting the sources of drinking water. The goals have some overlap, but they're not exactly the same. And so conservation has long focused on the water quality side of that that has most implications under the Clean Water Act, and has done a little bit of focus on source water protection, but not nearly to the level that we'd like to see. And so under the 2018 Farm Bill, we were able to work with our partners and work with really a large bipartisan coalition on the Hill that was really interested in the recent incidents that have happened, what happened in Toledo in 2014 with cyanobacteria, and what happened in Salem, Oregon last year, and many other incidents that have happened where something has caused a significant issue in a source water area and then has caused either a very serious issue that was avoided or one that was unfortunately not avoided in the source water and the consequences to the cities and towns that are served by those areas. And trying to figure out how could we use conservation dollars and conservation programs to help reduce the risks of those things and move forward collaboratively together. Happy to report that now source water protection is one of the listed goals of the conservation programs. It has been done in some projects in the past, but it was never a specific goal until now. There's a provision that NRCS is directed to work with water utilities and with their state technical committees, for which AWWA and other organizations have been pushing water utilities to join those committees to make sure they interact regularly, to figure out source water protection areas that are of high priority in every state. There's a provision to increase the cost share for provisions that have big impacts, positive impacts for source water quality. And then most certainly not least, is 10% of the conservation dollar spending, with the exception of the Conservation Reserve Program, will be spent on source water protection projects moving forward. So that's potentially $4 billion over the next 10 years, which is incredible because we know that there were some, but there was never quantified previously, and we think it's a significant increase. So basically, we've been working with the sector to really encourage them to participate in more projects like the one you saw here, examined here in the study. So we've created like this fun little YouTube video that shows farmers and water utility staff working together and explains the concepts and everything, and as well as you know, both technical material and kind of overview material for the sector to work, figure out how to work with NRCS and how to figure out how to work with partners on the ground to help meet these goals. And in the last RCPP round, we helped our utility members partner with others in the sector across the agricultural sector to submit three RCPP applications that were new. One of them, the Otter Lake one, was included in the study, but unfortunately it has had some issues getting off the ground. We do think it still will happen, but it's just been delayed a little bit. There's that one. There's one in North Carolina that's about $1.5 million to do stream bank restoration and do safer agrochemical mixing to help prevent the accidental introduction of those chemicals into the water. And then there's a really big one, over $8 million in Kansas, to reduce the risk of cyanobacteria blooms in the Milford Reservoir. So these are significant size projects that are going to make a measurable, defined impact. And now we have some more tools. Because of this study, we have some more tools and some more reference points to help us figure out how much impact for these projects that will help protect sources of drinking water into the future. And so we've been encouraging our member utilities to reach out to NRCS. I encourage everybody in the room here to participate with NRCS's processes. They seem to be taking the source water protection mandate very seriously in all the directives that have been sent out over the past, well, since the bill has been passed, there's been a significant emphasis on source water protection, finding areas and finding partners and projects. And the more that people reinforce that, the better. I'm happy to report that we're seeing actions happening all over the country of NRCS, agricultural partners, and water utilities starting to come to the table in places where they didn't before. It's going to take time before we see significant numbers of new projects, but I'm confident that we're on the right path generally. Of course, the larger the opportunity, the more people are going to be able to participate. And so echoing everybody else here, there is always opportunity for more action with more funding. And we're seeing these collaborations being built all over, and we really just need to continue the momentum. And with that, I will yield the rest of the time for questions and discussion.
All right, thank you, Adam. I apologize for all the technical issues. It's not a full briefing without a few of those. But we're now going to open up for questions, and I'm also going to make available all of these presentations online, if that's okay with the speakers, and I'll circulate those to everyone who's RSVP. But if you did not RSVP, just go to our website. They'll be up, and a recording of this will be up maybe in the next day or so. And you can share that with any colleagues that might have missed it. But with that, any questions?
There's a lot of focus on monitoring conservation practices and the successes of them with a funding level from the last farm bill. Where is that balance between spending additional dollars on a very expensive edge-of-field monitoring machine, whatever you call them, and those dollars necessarily having to come away from paying a farmer to do a practice? Where's that balance, taking away dollars of actually implementing conservation on the ground?
I can take a stab at that. So this isn't going to apply to every project, but for ones that include the water sector, we're experts in water quality monitoring, and that's one of the things that our folks do day in and day out, and they can be a big part of that. So it doesn't necessarily take away from the federal dollars to increase the monitoring, because it could be the partners who are bringing partner dollars and partner expertise to the table who do it.
Anyone else want to add to that?
I'd only make the argument that you want to know where the most effective conservation is happening. So even within a landscape, even within a watershed, certain practices are going to give you different results in different parts of the watershed. Most watershed agencies, people who are, you know, stakeholders are doing that, know their landscape better than anybody else. But you want to also help others who are starting new projects to sort of inform them. So, there's partner dollars that are coming in. There are, you know, many of the projects that we looked at were already working with local colleges and, you know, community schools, community colleges, to do most of the sampling, monitoring, testing. So there's you know, outsourcing that can be done locally. So I don't think it is that expensive, but it's just like setting protocols and making sure that, you know, what are we looking for as sort of a common metric that, you know, we want to see. Because in some cases, the watershed monitoring, I described the time scale, like, you know, before and after, but also where you do it. Like some of the monitoring was happening, you know, at the end of a stream where, you know, this is our goal, this is our stretch. You know, it's a 100-mile stream. We are doing monitoring at the end of the stream. You know, you've left like several acres, several square kilometers, you know, left unmonitored. So, like, you wouldn't be able to tell much at the end of a stream by saying, you know, this is the phosphorus level after 5 years. So there are those gaps that we need to fill. I understand the balance for sure.
Yeah, I think it's a balance issue. It's a fair question. But I do think in the long term, having that information is going to mean being able to use those resources as effectively as possible. But I think that we have to find a balance where we're not taking too much money away from farmers to actually implement the practices. I don't think that there's a magic number, though.
I would just echo what's already been said on this. It's a difficult question, but it is one that we have to grapple with.
Any other questions?
One thing that may be a good approximation is that in the nonprofit world, when you're doing a project, you should be setting aside like 10% of the project actually evaluated at the end. So if you're looking at X amount of dollars, there should be like 10% put aside for the evaluation of it. Now, a lot of times what happens is people don't do that. So they're at the end, they're just scrambling to try to evaluate whatever project they're doing. But it's considered the best management practice in the nonprofit world to put 10% of a given project aside for the evaluation.
Any other questions?
Yes, I was wondering about how do these conservation practices work with industrial agriculture, and is there a difference between working with more like individual family farms versus larger industrial agriculture and those kinds of things on these conservation issues, and do some of them work better with other groups or somewhat?
Who wants it?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, there are some practices that make more sense for industrial agriculture. There's a lot of water quality practices specifically for like confined animal feedlot operations that wouldn't make sense for small family farms. You know, I think that the suite of conservation practices that USDA and NRCS has kind of covers the whole spectrum. Yeah, I think that's why it's important to have all of those kind of tools in the toolbox so that you can be making sure to have conservation on both the small and the large farms.
I would just add, I mean, I think there is something for everyone, but smaller operations are you know, generally going to have a harder time paying for some of these things, so which is why the federal investment is so important and why in the Farm Bill, Congress decided to sort of put additional investment behind particularly effective practices.
And there's also the whole EQIP CSP distinctions that you can do, you know, select practices in part of your farm rather than, you know, commit wholesale the entire farm to, you know, engaging in conservation if you are not sure how that's going to turn out.
I'd just add that the water sector, we're interested in working with farms of all sizes.
All right. Any more questions? All right, then. With that, I will say good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. And like I said, I will circulate presentations and the briefing recording, and those presentations will be up on our website in the next day or so. Thank you all for being here, and have a great afternoon.